in the broader perspectives of risk management, you have seen some very good papers already on the financial aspects. And all of you, my understanding, are in the financial field. I have been in the information systems field. Actually, in the information systems field, I don't have a whole bunch to tell you about this morning. It's essentially trying to minimize security problems or whatever. So I'm going to start off talking about more economic background of risk, and then look at some of the things that Desh Wu and I have done, and then focus on supply chain risk management. Risk is really something that you have to take on. You cannot avoid all risk. If you avoided all risk, we'd be troglodytes living under a rock someplace, and there's no future in that. You don't make any progress if you don't take on any risk. And risk management's been around a long time. It's probably around since Moses, but Lloyd's of London is clearly focused on risk management. And there have been a lot of developments that you've all been involved with. And so the main purpose of doing business is to find those risks that you're good at coping with and make a living on managing those risks. And then the other ones you can sell off or insure or whatever. The field of economics has always been interested in risk in that a number of economists have looked at risk, and in 1826, the theory was that risk is that's how you make money. He equated risk with profit. That's too broad a statement, but roughly. Hawley in 1907 considered entrepreneurs to be risk seekers. And Knight basically took what to me is a mathematical leap of faith in calling uncertainty the non-quantitative part. Risk is the measurable part, probabilities, and profit comes about mathematically, in his view, from taking on risk. If you don't take any risk on his theory, you don't make any money. There's some truth to that, not completely. Harry Markowitz, of course, in the 50s came up with risk is variance. That's kind of a statistical view of risk. It's probably overstating it again. There's more to it, I would think. But he came up with a lot of valuable tools in the form of a Pareto optimality, of efficient frontiers that have been very useful and important. And he also pointed out the existence of correlations that have proven to be important. It does no good to put all of your eggs to diversify if all of the things that you're putting your investments in go up and down together. And so diversification becomes useful. And Sharpe extended that, basically built on Markowitz, to talk about risk as opportunity. And Fama came up with the efficient market theory, where the market price is viewed as a device to incorporate perfect information. And then there's random walks around that type of equilibrium value. So the idea of risk is fundamental to economic theory. If you look at how people behave in the past, you find some aberrant behaviors. Anybody remember the tulip mania in the 17th century? It just fascinates me how people can go crazy buying these stupid flower bulbs from Turkey that are probably, to me, 25 cents is what I'd put on them. My wife would pay $150 probably for the same bulb that I'd pay a quarter for. But people were selling their houses to buy tulip bulbs. And for a while, they were making money at it. But you kind of see this over and over and over. The South Sea Company invested in real estate in the Pacific. And they had this phenomenal occurrence where people would invest money, make tons of money for a while, and then they'd lose it all. It's very much like going to a casino. How many of you go to casinos? I think my experience is those that understand statistics don't go to casinos. I don't understand why anybody goes to a casino, but it's one of the growth industries in the United States. The Mississippi Company was got a lot of investing in land in around what now is New Orleans. One of the investors was Isaac Newton. Isaac Newton was, we would view as one of us, right? He's a very smart guy. He does a lot of theoretical developments. He put his money in the Mississippi company and lost it all. Is that a rational person? Well, he probably was. He concluded that he can calculate the motion of heavenly bodies, but he can't figure out the madness of people, of which he was one. And that has happened over and over and over. There was a bubble in the London Market Exchange in 1983. Risks were viewed as independent. They weren't. Everybody invested in covering land in Florida. Hurricane Alicia wiped them out and caused a great deal of problems. One of the first applications of financial computer models to investments was in the stock exchange in the United States. They managed to come up with a system where you had this triple witching hour in October 19th, 1987. It all fell apart. Now, actually, I had students at the time that measured the performance. It seemed to collapse or exaggerate the ups and downs of the market. Over the long term, it seemed to equilibrate or recover. But people lost a lot of money in a very short time on Black Monday. One of my favorite stories is long-term capital management. It shows the benefits of theoretical models, right? Black and Scholes and Merton got the Nobel Prize for this model, right? It was pricing derivatives. And long-term capital management was formed to take advantage of that. You had to pay a phenomenal amount of money to subscribe to this. And it took off. They were making billions, right? And then what happened is they had a lot of money. You can't just leave money laying around anymore, and you can leave electricity laying around. It just goes against the grain to have money sitting there drawing no interest, although right now many of us are doing just that. But they invested in Russian banks, which at the time were kind of uncertain. And they collapsed in long-term capital management. Was the first company to be called too big to fail. And they didn't let it fail. And Merton and Scholes still have very nice houses. They're on 60 Minutes, and they show their homes. They still live a good life. They did not lose everything. Many of their investors did. But models basically have to assume things. Just as the last presentation talked about the electricity model, you have to make some assumptions in order to develop a closed-form solution. Models are simplifications. And reality always includes more, it seems. And one of the trends that impresses me is people keep biting over and over and over. Anybody remember Jay Gould? Who was Jay Gould? You don't talk about Jay Gould anymore. In the 1850s and through 1900, he was do you talk about him ever? He's a fascinating person to read about. He had this Erie Railroad thing that he would boost. He was an investor on Wall Street. And he would flood the market with this Erie Railroad stock. And he would promote it. And it would go from, say, $10 up to $100. And he would get this ring together to boost this price up by manipulating the stock market. It would go up to $100, and he would, at 95, he would betray all of his colleagues and sell out. And, of course, when he sold, the price went down, and all of his colleagues got stuck. And he did that 10 times. And one of my students says, who would be dumb enough to keep investing in that? Investors were dumb enough to do that. It happened 10 times. And he lived to be a very rich man into the 20th century. He owned most of the railroads in the country at one time. People will continue to bite, was the point. Information in our modern times, there are bubbles as well as the dot-com bubble around 2002 that has had a big effect on information systems. There's a real estate bubble in 2008 in California and Colorado and in Nevada and other places. I hope You don't. I don't think you have that problem in Canada, do you? Did you have a real estate bubble? Hopefully you won't. There's a big difference between Canadian and American treatment of real estate. What's the difference? Actually, Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980? And what made him popular was deregulation, right? There was the United States went through this traumatic period in the 1930s, and the Depression came, and I still can't figure out why people could let it get that bad. But they put all kinds of banking laws on and separated banks. That some people could give mortgages, others couldn't. And it was very regulated kind of an environment. And Ronald Reagan came along in 1980 after we'd had 50 years to get over the Depression and said, you know, this regulation's hurting us a whole bunch. Let's get rid of it and allow the market to pretty much control things. I don't think you did that in Canada, did you? That's my impression. So the United States cruises along, and we'll get to that story in a few minutes. But I think that the biggest driver was deregulation, actually, and I think Canada has not yet had this real estate collapse because you still have the sense to have some regulation of banks. So I think you should be commended for your personally. Now, it sounds like Luis may be worried, but there have been a flood of books since 2008, and I have bought a number of those. This is really a fascinating story of what happened in the 2000s with the real estate market. Remember that since the 1930s, the price of houses in the United States tended to go up all the time. In fact, anybody that ever lived in California in here? And I realize this is Trump. You have. The price in California used to go up 10-15% a year, year after year after year for decades. It'll never go down is the conclusion that people have. They will invest in it and bet their farm that it will continue to go up. And unfortunately, what goes up cannot continue to go up forever, and it collapsed. And so in 2005, this financial industry was warped with a lot of deregulation. I taught at Texas A&M for 20 years, and on the faculty before I got there was a gentleman named Phil Graham, who was a senator, and he came up with one of the acts that deregulated the banking industry in 1999 or so. And so about that time, banks started to take more kinds of, they basically allowed any bank to give a mortgage, and you ended up with a market of trying to sell mortgages. And so they also would offload these mortgages immediately. So you had, back in my day when I first got a mortgage, you got a mortgage with the banking institution, you paid that same institution until the loan was paid off, so they were very cautious about who they gave mortgages to. They changed the rules around 1999 due to he was in the econ department at A&M. They said that anybody can give a mortgage and you can sell it immediately. And so they created this market where you have people pushing mortgages to people, to banks that would buy them and rely upon your models to package them into risk-free or at least rated to be risk-free entities like CDOs and all of these kinds of things. And so you really screwed up the market, and you made it unregulated completely, and you have all of these shenanigans going on where people pushing mortgages on especially internet banking, Ameritrade, I'll say the wrong thing. There were online internet mortgages that were sold, that were immediately sold to banks that would immediately package them into these instruments of derivatives that they would sell to investors that were rated AAA by these rating institutes. And we wonder why bubbles occur. CDSs came about from in 94 when J.P. Morgan was insuring the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Exxon faced a $5 billion fine. They drew on a $4.8 billion line of credit from J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan Well, Exxon's the largest company in the world. It's got an economy bigger than most countries. It's a gigantic, out-of-control kind of entity. So J.P. Morgan did not want to alienate Exxon. And so they got the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development to swap the default risk. And that's where they came about with this idea of exchanging risk. Now, about 2005, you got banks trying to make more money by creating products to sell to investors, and you got these mortgage granting agencies I talked to you about trying to push all of these mortgages to anybody. And then you got Wall Street packages that created all these CDOs and everything else. Before 2007, CDOs were primarily focused on corporate debt. After 2007, they shifted to mortgages. And so they would blend mortgages of different grades and locations. I mean, you'd lived since the 1930s, that's 70 years, where the price of houses have done nothing but go up. How could you possibly go wrong betting on the price of houses, especially if once in a while one area might have a depression? If you collect them from, say, New England and California and the Midwest and Southeast, you can't go wrong, right? Because you're hedged perfectly. And the rating agencies cooperated. Actually, the SEC decreed that they switched the way in which rating agencies were paid. Before the changes, they were paid not by the people they rated. After a change, the people that they rated paid them. Moody's and Standard and Poor's and Fitch were the three rating agencies, and they all ended up being paid by the same entities that they were rating. And that creates a conflict of interest. As much as they may argue that they were professional and honest, their ratings seem to comply with the requirements of their customers. There have been ratings failures before, including long-term capital mortgage, but not on the scale that we've suffered in the United States in 2008. As far as the mortgage side goes, the loan officers often convince their applicants to lie. There was a case that Nocera and McLean pointed out of a part-time housekeeper that had an income of about $1,300 a month that fronted for her sister to get a loan, which sounds, you know, you'd do that for your sister probably. But this part-time housekeeper lost her job and had to return to Europe. And so this mortgage essentially was defaulted upon. They also pushed one on, but the point is it was not a safe mortgage to give in the first place. But they didn't care. They were pushing them. I'm trying to give you examples of extreme cases. There was a dairy milker with an income of $1,000 a month. In this case, the mortgage company just lied on the form and filled out things that would satisfy regulators. It wasn't the dairy milker's fault. It was the person that filled out the mortgage institution. There was a janitor earning $3,900 a month that himself claimed to be an account executive. And so he bought a $600,000 house. But these tended to be kind of common kinds of things. And so I personally don't think it was a big surprise that we had a mortgage bubble. I think it represents kind of ongoing human behavior. There will always be things that we always try to take advantage of that look like really good things that fall apart and collapse. So we have risk management, essentially, is aimed at looking at models to try to provide tools to protect us from these collapses, which are bubbles. One of the people that is in the consulting business for risk management is Hubbard, who has looked at risk management from a practical perspective of planning and watching and do something. Because when it comes down to it, a chief executive officer anymore is responsible for dealing or anticipating every kind of risk that they can. The kinds of risks that you specialize in monitoring are financial And value at risk is one of the tools that you have come up with. And you all know what it is. And I just use this for my students to try to explain it, but it's essentially a fairly straightforward kind of a statistical concept of trying to cover the 99% worst case or whatever percent worst case you want, right? And there are a lot of variants to that, some of which were presented in the first presentation this morning. And that is widely used. Basel III was mentioned in the first presentation, but banks use VAR to measure the amount of risk that they have, and they compute that daily, and they anticipate what they're going to need in the way of capital reserves to make sure that they are able to cope with things using historical prices on a very short-term scale. Now, at the limit, if you play the game often enough, just like the electricity business, if you play it often enough, things are going to occur at the outlying stage. And one of the problems has been the distribution that you ought to apply. We tend to think that data tends to be normally distributed, and sometimes it is. But it isn't always. And Hubbard has argued that one of the problems with value at risk is the distribution that you look at, but that's been well studied. Another approach from your industry is conditional value at risk, which is the same idea, only it considers not only that probability level, but also the average in the tail of where you would be. So Dash Wu and I initially looked at distributions. It doesn't come up with anything that other people haven't found out, but we looked at five indexes of data and tested them. It's very easy to do with software, statistical software. And actually, the statistical software is interesting because Crystal Ball is the software I used. It would allow you to use Student T, which is for a small... Student T wasn't designed for this kind of data. But Crystal Ball will let you use it anyway. And it fit best. It won. At risk is the other major simulation software. It won't even allow you to test Student T because theoretically it shouldn't fit, right? I mean, it's for small samples. But with Crystal Ball, it fit the best. Logistic came out second. Normal and log normal were fairly good fits. The implication essentially is what people have been saying in your field for a long time: fat tails exist. And the difference it makes on the data that we looked at is that the true amount of money at risk, which you want to minimize, goes way up if you make these different distribution assumptions. And the T is the one with the worst fit. Actually, Hubbard suggests a different distribution, the power distribution, that would he thinks is even better. But the point is, essentially, people have been making decisions on this blue line kind of a thing. And actually, their model is false in that it's, what is that, two or three times worse? They're underestimating the amount of money they should have kept in reserve two or three times because of that one assumption about a distribution. Correlation also makes a difference. If you look at the profitability, it's going to, if you didn't consider correlation, the amount that you would actually get in blue is significantly lower. Again, you already knew that. But my point is you can use a variety of different models, and the assumptions that you make are the key point. So Dash and I have done other kind of work, and the point of this primarily was to look at, in this case, the data we used were the investment funds listed here. The point is that your historical data measures past. That's the curse of statistics. That's all we can deal with, is what's happened before. My argument is that the future is never going to be like that. It might be likely to be like that. There's, I think in the prior presentations they talked about memory duration. You know, some things have better memory than other, like wind memory is short. But after 2008, you were dealing with an entirely different statistical regime, is the point. And if you look at these indexes, you would base your decisions on your old data. That's these three columns. After that collapse, you end up with these statistics. So here's the mean for those portfolios on a daily basis. That's why the numbers are so small. This is their standard deviation in their minimum and their maximum. This is the data showing the mean after that period for about a year's period of time with its standard deviation in mins and max. My point primarily, well, it's kind of interesting if you look at them specifically. You can see that the means are all positive except the Euro stocks and the Treasury yield bond in the old period. In the new period, the means are all negative except for the Chinese index and the Treasury yield bond. The standard deviations all go up. And, of course, that means the mins and the maxes are going to have a wide range by definition. And that in itself might be statistically interesting, but the point is that we base our decisions on data. And the only thing we can look at is the old period. And when regime changes occur, when there's a massive change in economic circumstances like 2008 in the U.S., not so much in Canada, your models can't be expected to give you the kinds of things that you had hoped for. They are assumptions you've got. And so you've got two philosophical approaches to this. I think you're in the business of making the models better. That's what you do for a living. And that's the economic theoretical way. But you're always going to leave something out. The last presentation pointed that out. He says, well, there's some things I had to simplify. It was still a valid, interesting, good model, but he left things out. That's the definition of a model. And Black-Scholes, to me, is a great example, a profound model that really impressed people and ultimately caused a lot of trouble, in my view. So there's practical benefits, and I point to two people. One of them graduated from the College of Business Administration at the University of Nebraska, believe it or not. That's astounding. But he doesn't believe a lot in models. He believes in his experience. And George Soros, who I find fascinating, he writes tons of books. He has a very interesting career. He was a philosophy student originally, studying with Popper in London, and flunked. And so he had to do something to make a living, so he became an investor and made tons of money. And he basically made it by saying, you know, these guys are making a lot of assumptions. And he figured out what they were, and he figured out where he thought they were wrong, and he bet against them. And that, to me, is fascinating. There is a lot of work at coming up with better models, including chaos theory. I've always loved chaos theory. It's really interesting. But the thing that bothers me about chaos theory is they always point out the one case out of 1,000 where it worked. They never mention the 999 where it doesn't tell you anything. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't pursue it. You might stumble on something useful with chaos theory. But I still, you know, I'm dubious about the probability of it paying off. But somebody should try and lead to better models. Models always are flawed. As I said, Soros got rich taking advantage of what he thought people were thinking wrong. Buffett got rich not by worrying about what other people did. He just looked for bargains. He says, that company has got assets worth $100,000 and its share price on the market, I could buy the whole blasted thing for $20,000. So he'd buy that. He's looking for these bargains and then hanging on to it and taking advantage of it rather than day trading or going, you know, exchanging stock. He has an interesting rule. If he doesn't understand it, he won't invest in it. And that includes IT. That includes Intel, Microsoft, all of those dot-com companies. So that's one of the reasons he made money, I guess. He wasn't stuck with that. Another guy that I think writes a lot of interesting stuff is Nassim Taleb. He talks about black swans. Black swans essentially are the idea that we have this philosophical belief that if we haven't observed it, it can't exist. Last I presented this was to my class this spring, and there was an Australian student in the class, and she says, oh yeah, that's our national bird in Australia or something. There's a black swan. But in England, they hadn't seen any black swans, so they couldn't possibly exist. Well, that kind of goes back to the point I was trying to make about using the statistics. Old data is all we have a picture of, and it doesn't include what the future will include. And Taleb was very interested in these fat tails. Investors tend to assume data is normally distributed. Well, it's not. It's kind of. It will get you a long way, but you will ultimately face some problems. And at the bottom there are Hubbard's ideas of how distributions would work with real data. Normal's way down the list. So I'm interested in alternatives, approaches about how you could approach risk. One of those I have always thought was, in my field's multiple criteria decision making, essentially, these guys are fundamental to that. Human cognitive psychology is very important because humans tend to make decisions with a lot. That's what we have to do to cope with life, we have our biases. And we frame ourselves with what we have seen lately. That goes back to the point about we look at the past statistics and try to extend them into the future. And we are very lousy at estimating the probability of rare events. There isn't much. In Nebraska, we have hundreds and hundreds of TV channels. There are periods where none of them are worth watching. So you can watch the Weather Channel now and then. You have these horror stories, scenarios about the next asteroid. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. Any of you seen those stupid shows? So they're telling you an asteroid is going to hit the Earth. How many of you have asteroid insurance? I don't. I'm pretty risk averse. I'm not going to. We all travel a lot. You go through airports. We probably, I think, overestimate the probability of... I'm kind of sick and tired of security checks, to tell you the truth, is my point. Maybe they all aren't necessary. Maybe they are. We have different opinions about that. Another approach to dealing with risk is... I saw this. These people's book advertised on Fareed Zakaria's show, GPS. And there are a couple of guys from Yale, I believe, that are economists. And their whole premise is that standard economic theory makes too many assumptions. They assume that decision makers have perfect knowledge of all the available options, and they evaluate them looking at all of the advantages and probabilities, and they optimize. That's what most of us, including me in the room, rely upon, right? They propose there are other objectives that are important. And actually, this I kind of buy. Altruism is not an evil kind of a thing. It's not. I think it also exists. And I think it exists more in Canada than it does in the United States. Altruism does matter very often. For instance, I was going to ask the last presenter, and I didn't because I thought he was out of time. Would there be any of these windmills if there wasn't any subsidies? I'm sorry, he left. Huh? Yeah. And it's really interesting. I just went into Denmark. I counted 100 windmills in the North Sea. And in Finland, they have all kinds of them. In Nebraska and South Dakota and Iowa, they're just got farms of hundreds of these things. Nebraska's a little more conservative. We have two in Lincoln. And the I gave a class to some electrical engineers from the Omaha Public Power District about 10 years ago. At that time, I says, well, why don't you get wind power? And they said, oh, that's a really stupid idea. Nobody, you couldn't possibly use it. They've changed their tune because social pressure seems to drive it. And they are building wind farms. I can remember in the few months in the Army when I was in electrical engineering business for a little bit, the line loss seems phenomenal. But I talked to an engineer from Brazil at a conference a year ago, and he says, well, it doesn't matter. It's free energy. So the line loss is not a big problem. But that, to me, you had some interesting stuff about storing it. But still, in your model, you're assuming a lot of regulatory incentives. That's the whole premise of the model. And so, you know, that comes about because somebody says we need wind power because if we don't, the glaciers are all going to melt and we'll have a Northwest Passage after all. Actually, Canada's probably for that, aren't you? There are a lot of things that matter. I'm going to have to fly through the supply chain stuff. Dash and I have worked in trying to extend the idea of risk management to information systems as well as supply chain. We have in IT, it is essentially important because you have a lot of regulatory kinds of things like Sarbanes-Oxley that affect the business of IT. And we've done some stuff there. But the primary interest is in risk management with respect to supply chains. And they're very important. Supply chains face a lot of risks. Land Rover ran across a key supplier being insolvent that led to Land Rover having to lay off 1,000 people. Dole was hit in 1998 by a hurricane and the banana plantations. That hit their supply chain. Ford had to close 5 plants after the 9/11 2001 because their supply chain was disrupted. There have been a lot of other impacts in Indonesia. There was an earthquake in Taiwan that led to Dell and Apple being short. They had different approaches. Apple suffered. Dell changed their price incentives and were able to adapt. So they're a good example of being able to cope. A famous fire in New Mexico burnt down a semiconductor factory. Ericsson in Sweden didn't react and suffered, and they suffered severely. Nokia had designed modular components that enabled them to move to alternative chips, and they jumped ahead of Ericsson and took over that business. There are lots of different sources of where risks can occur in supply chains. Political events. If you had a lot of oil from Libya, you may have had a supply chain disruption lately. There's a lot of other kinds of things that are important in supply chains. And there's things that you can do. You can postpone things through modular design like Nokia did, or standardization of parts so that you can use them across different, so that you've got alternatives when things go wrong. And things will go wrong is my conclusion. You can build a strategic safety stock, which is not a new idea. That means you have a lot of inventory, which is what management scientists exist to figure out how can we eliminate all of that unnecessary wasted cost. But sometimes you need them. You can have a flexible supply base, not just dealing with the lowest cost vendor, but encouraging a variety of vendors so that you don't rely on one. You can come up with supply incentives, like subsidizing flu vaccine, for instance, is one example given. You can have flexible transportation, meaning that if shipping gets shut down from piracy in the Indonesian Straits, you've got air delivery if you need to, or some other source. You can look at dynamic pricing like Dell did, or what American Airlines does, or all the airlines do with yield management kinds of models. You can come up with other ways to influence demand besides price by assortment planning. Dell often uses alternative monitors, for instance. Or you can do like Zara does and have kind of a silent product rollover. What Zara does that's really impressive is that they don't carry stock in their department store. They just have one or two units and see which ones sell. And if they sell, they're able to ramp up immediately and flood their stores with the stuff that proved to be popular. But they don't get stuck with all the lemons that their competitors have. So there are things you can do in a supply chain. What Dash and I have done in the last book is try to propose three kinds of models. This has four. We didn't do anything with the systems failure method, which is a British approach of applying systems. I still like it, but we didn't include it. Monte Carlo simulation has been mentioned already in the first presentation. It's a very good risk management tool, obviously. I like multiple criteria optimization that we talked about, but you can also utilize information technology, and the example was a balanced scorecard that we used. In this case, we had an example in the book that isn't worth going over here, but essentially, to try to explain this real quickly, you can have exchange distributions as a differential between, say you get quoted prices from five vendors that are shown there. It looks like you ought to buy the Chinese or sign a contract in China, right? It's 82 cents versus 85 cents in Vietnam. They both have distributions. So those two are pretty close, actually. And you have a normal distribution of change, exchange rate distribution, that is different. It's higher for China, which might eliminate all of the advantage they have over Vietnam. But there's more things to it, is our point. You can have probabilities of product failure, like how good is the quality of the product. And so the probability of failure from Germany is very good in this model, and Taiwan is very good in this model. I made these numbers up, so they don't mean anything. But for purposes of demonstration, you may pay 82 cents, but 90% of the time that's great. 10% of the time it's worse. I mean, it's terrible. You also could have organizational failure in Vietnam. Basically, the company might go broke. The vendor might go broke. You could have political failure. You could have a revolution or change of government that would totally disrupt things. There's a lot of different things that you could have. I just had three. There could be an infinite number. You can't model an infinite number. You have to make a model. You simplify it. Anyway, the expected price can get affected by all that, and you can simulate that, is what we did. Essentially, you get interesting distributions where you have the penalty price in blue over there. And so you can, with simulation, compare all of those. I think you would get the idea of what to do with that. The other second model is multiple criteria analysis. Essentially, you need a systematic way to identify what criteria are important to you, and then we demonstrated how you could use the SMART method to develop weights and take all of these factors and put them into scores in the bottom matrix, multiply them together, and come up with a multiple criteria model ranking each of those. And so in this case, the Taiwanese model came out ahead, followed by Alabama, despite the fact that on price, China was much, much better and Vietnam was very good. There's other factors. That's what Akerlof and Schilling were trying to say. The last thing I had was a financial scorecard, or balance scorecard. Financial is one of the perspectives. This comes from Harvard Business Review. I'm sure if you haven't seen it, you can find it. Once a year, they have a new article about balanced scorecard. But you can look at a variety of different factors. Overall, I think Buffett has some good things to tell us. Just be only invest in things you understand. I really like Soros, and if you'll allow me 1 minute, his reaction to bubbles is that's where you can make a lot of money. One book had this description of bubbles. Soros publishes actually a lot of books. That's his view of the same seven parameters. So you have this thing that starts off this a bubble, and Soros says, if you can figure out what that's going on, go ahead and invest, although it's kind of hard to see that at that stage. But then you see that things accelerate and expand, so invest more. And prices start to go up. And then you start to see some challenges occur. And then there's a lot of overtrading and mass trading. That's when Soros says you want to get out. Then there is this period of doubt, kind of at the plateau of a bubble. You ought to be gone by then. But that is actually the optimal time to bail. If you looked at a model, that's where the derivative turns to zero. That's where you ought to get out. And then everybody sells, and that's too late. And then everything is gone. There's interesting things about Taleb has about statistics. If someone flipped a coin, we all know there's a 50-50 probability of heads or tails. And if you observe 99 heads in succession, we're all trained to say the 100th flip has got a 50-50 chance, right? Taleb says, that coin's crooked. And so basically there's more to it than just the probabilities. And so make sure the statistics are appropriate. The actual risks that casinos, who are the best risk managers in the world, the things that have really hurt them, there was a tiger bit, I can't remember if it was Siegfried or Roy. That cost them about $100 million. They don't lose money on gambling. They've got reserves to cover that. And they make a lot of money with people trying to overcome that system. Another example was they had a contractor who suffered in constructing a hotel annex. And he sued and lost the court case. And so he came back and dynamited the casino, or he tried to. How are you supposed to insure against that? How are you supposed to insure against the tiger? Actually, I guess you could avoid stupid shows where you have tigers and people in the same cage, but that's kind of a biased opinion of my own. Casinos are required to file with the Internal Revenue Service. A third case was that they had an employee in charge of doing that, and the employee, for some unknown reason, didn't. Blew it off. Of course, the IRS didn't care. They sued the casino. And another time, a casino's daughter was kidnapped. Now, being a good father, he took the casino's money to pay off the ransom. Those are unexpected left-field kinds of risks, sort of like asteroids. But the problem is how do you sift out the asteroids from these other risks? And so consider multiple criteria and mistrust the assumptions in a model is the conclusions that I would make. And I'm sorry I'm a little over. Yes, sir.
You talked about asteroids and you sort of had the feeling that we tend to overestimate the probability of things like that happening and worry about it too much. And I don't agree with that. But in the late 90s, I used to work at an investment bank, and our bank had a guy in charge of business contingency planning who'd been an Army officer for many years. And he went from department to department and asked questions about what would you do if this was a mistake. Because I was the junior guy in my group, they made me talk to this guy because my boss has been more awake this time. And they said, you know, this guy asked me, what would you do if an asteroid hit Toronto?
Yeah.
And this was the story. And of course, it's kind of ridiculous, but my point is that a few years later, an asteroid sort of did hit New
yeah.
York, right?
With yeah.
9/11. So it wasn't necessarily at the time we made fun.
Well, I think you bring up a good point. Managers or chief executives are responsible for these impossible events occurring. And an asteroid I gave as an example of, I wouldn't bet against that, but chief executive officers are responsible for being able to cope with such a thing. So it's kind of a counterexample to what I was saying, but I agree with you. It also supports what I was saying in the sense that I probably used it as an example of, well, there are impossible things. When I shouldn't have, but we can't anticipate everything that's going to happen to us. We just have to cope with them, and being able to cope with them is all we can rationally hope to do. Yes.
You mentioned political risk. I was just curious. Is that Glenn Hubbard, the guy you mentioned on the risk management?
I'd have to double check. He's a consultant. No, he is not a professor. He's a person that makes money. Although professors from Columbia probably make money too.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to mention that there's only
only so much risk that you can worry about, because if you start taking it to the extreme, you're only buying profitability.
Yes. And you are in the business to take on risks. And there's a difference between insuring risks and managing risks. And managing risks is preparing yourself by signing a portfolio of vendors, even though you pay a little extra, so that you won't be hit with the risk, is the point that I think is valuable, if any. Going back to the asteroid, I would not insure, you know, there's some things that could happen, but I don't, I'm willing to take that self-insurance risk. Actually, I found it really interesting. As you grow older, your risk aversion really changes. When I was young, I took on a lot of self-health insurance, meaning I couldn't afford the insurance. As I grow older, you know, you start to buy all kinds of esoteric insurances and things, and you're much more risk averse as you, well, a lot of it has to do if you got anything to lose. Okay, well,